Welcome to the second episode of From a Whisper to a Bang, a podcast about remembrance. My name's Megan Spencer, and I'm walking in the footsteps of my late grandfather, Corporal Harry Spencer, an Australian infantry soldier who became a prisoner of war during World War II. After he was captured in 1941 by the German army on the island of Crete. And I'm using Harry's epic handwritten war memoir to guide me. I'm in northern Germany, in a forest, just near the district town of Fallingbostel, also known now as Bad Fallingbostel. I've been living in Berlin for the last 2.5 years, and I've just driven 3.5 hours to be here. It's a town of about 11,000 people, surrounded by a big forest, lush farmland, and with a military training base nearby. It's quiet, isn't it? Peaceful. Beautiful sounds of nature. But 70 or so years ago, it wouldn't have sounded like this. In fact, it would have been quite different. Not peaceful at all. Loud, explosive, and terrifying. In World War II, my grandfather was a prisoner of war here. He was interned just down the road from where I'm standing, at Stalag 357 in the little village of Erbka. When Harry was here, he heard very different sounds.
At night we could hear the aircraft and see the bombing in the distance. It was so bright with searchlights that the bombs lit up the whole area. During the day we would see some of the big air raids with perhaps 1,000 bombers and hundreds of fighters, aircraft above and below them. We were in between such cities as Hanover, Hamburg, Berlin and Bremen, and the bombing on these places was continual.
Stalag 357 was the final of the four prison camps in which Harry was held during World War II as an Allied soldier. Arriving here by train mid-August 1944 with a broken jaw and in pretty bad shape, he spent months in the camp hospital. This is what he writes in his personal memoir about his arrival by train.
We went through the Berlin railway station. The glass dome had been all hit. All the glass was on the tracks. Then onto a place named Fallingbostel, not far from Hanover, which had been severely bombed. As aircraft were shot down, crew members were hanging from the electric light poles in the streets. We were taken from the horse vans, and I was feeling very weak. I laid down. I was exhausted. The German doctor had a look at me. I was a sorry sight, as my face was swollen, and he could see that my mouth was swollen right out. Also, the corners were festered.
A soldier captured in Crete as well, Harry's brother Nathaniel, was also in Stalag 357. And in the dying months of the war, in 1945, they became separated, sent out on forced marches, destination unknown. With the Allies closing in, things were getting really loud. But the German army, determined to keep prisoners out of Allied hands, marched them for days and even weeks to nowhere in particular. It was chaos. Listening now to the peaceful stillness, you wouldn't necessarily know that the crumbling foundations of a former prisoner of war compound is just down the road, all these decades later, and all but swallowed whole by the forest. You'd really have to go looking. And that's exactly what I've come here to do on a pilgrimage for my grandfather, my father and my family, before I finally leave Germany and move back to Australia. I'm hoping that by being here, having read his memoir, keeping it close by, and being in this place where Harry was too, somehow, the physical ruins I'll soon stand in front of might reveal something more to me about his experience. Exactly what, I'm not sure, All I know is that I feel compelled to come here, to be here, to try to take in this place with him in mind, in the hope that it might somehow help me understand what he went through, what they all went through in this time of war, and to learn from it. So we'll come back here a little later and we'll also visit the site of the very first prison camp Harry went to straight from Crete, Stalag 7A in Mosborg, in another quiet place. For now though, it's time to leave this peaceful forest of the north. From a whisper to a bang.
I have only a very few minutes to speak to you, and I have a very great deal to say. Now I want everybody, every individual, every commercial interest, every big establishment to take a personal interest in the prisoner of war street adoption scheme. Now if you will do this, if everyone will do this, if everyone will see it, they adopt a prisoner in every street, then this scheme must be a very great success.
That was Sir Leslie Wilson, Governor of Queensland in 1941, making an impassioned plea on behalf of the Red Cross for citizens to support Australian prisoners of war of World War II. In the year in which the ad was made, over 5,000 Australian troops were captured on Greece and Crete, and close to 1,000 in Tobruk. After Japan became involved, by war's end, almost 30,000 Australian service people had become prisoners of war in World War II. My grandfather was one of them.
Sure, well, Harry Spencer, looking at his service record, he's a really good example of the quite tough times prisoners had in Germany in the Second World War.
Lachlan Grant is a senior historian in the military history section at the Australian War Memorial. While in many ways different to the experience of those Australians held by the Japanese during World War II, Lachlan says that the German prisoner of war experience for Australians was also difficult and diverse. In the last episode, I invited Lachlan to take us into Harry's experience at the moment of capture in Crete. Now I ask him to walk us through Harry's experience as a POW when he gets to Germany. The first camp Harry is transported to is Stalag 7A in Mosborg. One of the biggest in Germany and also a transit camp, it housed prisoners from over 70 different countries. 150,000 prisoners of war passed through its gates.
Well, the prisoners, when they arrive in Mosborg, which is just north of Munich, in southern Germany. One of the things they talk about is that first winter. A lot of them were captured in Crete, and obviously. Some of them captured in North Africa, and some of them only have like sort of summer uniform. They don't have proper winter clothing. And they talk about how bitterly cold it was that first winter in Germany. And one of the issues that's going on in Germany at this time is their soldiers are on the outskirts of Moscow fighting against the Russians. And so winter clothes in Germany are being sent to German soldiers on the front line. So they're reliant on the Red Cross and winter clothing coming through there.
According to my grandfather's war service record, which Lachlan has in front of him, Harry is interned there from August 1941 until April 1943. Nathaniel is with him too.
Mosborg was quite a large camp, originally planned for 10,000 people. By the end of the war, it represented something of a shanty town. 80,000 prisoners were crammed into Mosborg camp. And from Mosborg, soldiers went on work parties, working on various details. And that's very much the story of prisoners of war, like your grandfather is working. Said officers by the Geneva Convention weren't compelled to work, but NCOs and other ranks were sent to work.
We were made to work in and around this camp for some time. They put us out to contractors as hired workers. Nat and I got separated as I was very ill with nephritis and was put in isolation. By the time I was well again, Nat had gone on one of these work parties, working in the suburbs as well as the city of Munich. Prisoners were kept working, clearing snow and keeping the streets clean, also doing building work. Nat worked as a bricklayer. One building they erected fell down a few weeks after they had finished because of the weak mixtures the prisoners would make when mixing mortar and concrete for the walls. This type of sabotage made it difficult to pick the culprits. If caught, death was the punishment.
Boredom is another factor the prisoners have to contend with.
Well, as you said, boredom and monotony is one of the banes of a prisoner's life. And working is often, for them, is a good thing in a way because it keeps their mind occupied and they're doing things during the day. But sport is often quite popular in some of the camps if they're not out at work. And, of course, you know, playing football, Australian football or rugby or soccer or other sporting events, as were theatres and concerts and things like that too.
Harry had a lot of photos from his time in Stalag 7A. Somehow he kept a camera with him, also getting photographs from others in the camp. There are incredible images of Nathaniel as the Workers' Party sports shot put champ, the camp mini-Olympics between the various nations, and high camp theatre shows with titles like Bonjour Paris, put on by French POWs, who frock up for the female roles in dresses made from camp blankets. Entertainment and humour seem to get them through the hardships, the lack of food, tough times, and the makeshift latrines open to the elements and intruders.
One evening, a keen Aussie who used to glean all the news off the camp and from hidden radios read out the astounding news that, in the warrant officer's compound, one, who had gone to the toilet the night before, was, during his efforts, bitten on the testicles by a rat. Much cheering was heard. The next day, on the exchange markets, what seemed to be everywhere was an object made from tin lids, lined with a piece of soft cloth. The thing had two strings to tie to the wearer. It was called a ball protector, for use in the WO's compound. During the news the same evening, the news hound reported that he'd interviewed the rat that had bitten the WO. He asked the rat why he did this to the WO, and the rat replied, "I have been shit on long enough by those bastards." End of quote. This, of course, was jovial stuff that did a terrific lot of good for our morale. Our newshound was held in high esteem for his efforts, an Australian and a credit to his country.
Harry talks a lot about food in his memoir. It wasn't always plentiful and mostly pretty limited. He recounts boiling up potatoes and stale bread puddings in billies, even skinning and butchering stray animals that wander into the various camps for food. He put his skills from growing up in a hard life during the 20s and 30s at home to use here in order to get by and to keep going. All of the prisoners who were in Germany, you know, during World War II, they'd all lived through the Depression. A lot of them were from the country. It was a very different time, and people just culturally in Australia were quite self-sufficient. Do you think that self-sufficiency that they'd had through already hardship at home, in a sense, economic, helped them stay alive in these camps?
I think that's certainly a factor. One thing with the Second World War generation, as you said, they grew up during the Depression. Their parents had often, or their uncles had fought in the First World War. Then they, as they reach adulthood, there's a Second World War as well. And I think there's an amazing ability when you read their life stories of just getting on with things. And no matter how hard it is, just sort of getting on with life and making amends with what's available at the time. And I think it probably didn't help prepare them for the ordeal that many of them lived through during the war.
I want you to think of the man who no doubt walked down your street, your own street, in the days of peace, whether he was going on his work, or whether he was going for his sport, or whether he was out with his family. Now that man today is ceaselessly pacing behind barbed wires in an enemy compound. Prisoner of war.
So let's head back to Harry's war service record. What other impressions do you take from this, his individual journey?
Well, from the camp at Moosburg, he's later moved to Lambsdorff, which is in Poland. This was also quite a large camp. It held up to 20,000 British prisoners of war. And by its evacuation in 1945, it was up to 50,000 prisoners in this camp. So you can imagine the overcrowding in these camps. And again, going back to prisoners of the Japanese, the place Changi is the one that is really iconic in Australian memory as being this huge camp that a lot of the prisoners went to. But some of these camps dwarf the Changi Prison War Camp in their size and their population. Changi had a fluctuating population, but at times they only had a few thousand people in it. But places like Moosburg and Lambsdorff, you're talking tens and tens of thousands of British and Allied prisoners crammed into these camps.
In his war service record, Harry lists that he spends almost 11 months in Stalag 8B in Lambsdorff in Ober-Silesia, and that the barracks were in bad condition. He also writes that for some of the time there, prisoners were shackled to each other, reportedly as reprisal action for the British, whom higher command believed had bound German POWs at Diep and elsewhere.
From Lambsdorff, prisoners were sent out on work parties and working in a variety of industries. They included paper factories, quarries, brickworks, steel mills, sawmills, iron foundries, sugar factories, cement factories, flax mills, gasworks, clay pits, railways and coal mines, through to forestry and even just town administration. Some people just had a desk job as well. So you had this huge variety of work that prisoners were sent out to do. And another factor working in Germany is that, too, they'd find themselves working alongside inmates from concentration camps, too. So the prisoners in Germany also, as Australians overseas in the Second World War in Germany, they also, they're witnesses to the crimes of the Nazis. They do see workers from the concentration camps when they're out working as well.
I was having a look at the Luger pistol and noticed it would not eject a bullet that had become jammed. I was trying to remove it with a stick when a hand reached over my shoulder. I noticed the arm was clad in a blue and white striped material, like pyjama material. It quickly dawned on me as to who this would belong to. I quickly swung around, and here was this chap dressed in the blue and white outfit. He wanted the revolver off of me. I shook my head and yelled for my mates, who came over and spoke to this chap in German. He explained that he was a political prisoner from a camp further along. And as he spoke, another of these poor chaps came out of the trees and, through our interpreter, explained how hungry they were. So we fed them what we could and then asked if they would like the horses and cart. They were so pleased, and we gave them two bikes as well. We left them and drove away.
So you do have these extraordinary tales that come out of from the war in Europe. In many ways, this is a great example of talking about the diversity of the experience. Prisoners all have their own individual journey through captivity, depending on what camp they're in, depending on what kind of job they're doing, where they're working, because conditions varied greatly, and that would depend on the guards, the attitude of the guards, the camp commandants, what the food was like in those camps, the hospital, the health conditions in the camps. One thing I often try and remember and tell people when I'm talking about the prisoner of war story is, you know, of those 30,000 Australians who are prisoners of war in the Second World War across Europe and Asia, there's 30,000 individual stories. And so you have to be careful to generalise about the prisoner of war experience, because they all have this individual journey through captivity.
From Ober-Silesia, in early March 1944, Harry is again transported to yet another camp, Stalag 357 in Thorn, also in occupied Poland. He remains there until August, when the camp is evacuated.
As the Allies are closing in from the British and Americans from the west and the Russians from the east, the Germans start moving the prisoners from those camps, because many of the camps are in the eastern part of the German Reich in Poland. And the prisoners are forced on these long marches to camps in central Germany, so as far away from those Allied front lines that are closing in from 1944. But that long march for some of the prisoners through those months, and it's quite a horrific experience, is they have to leave pretty much any of their personal possessions behind, except for what they're wearing and what food and medical supplies they're able to take with them. It's through the winter months. It's really harsh conditions. They sometimes come under attack by Allied fighter planes that are often roaming in Germany looking for targets on the roads, because usually the traffic on the roads are German military convoys or soldiers, so they come under attack at times by Allied aircraft. And some of these marches go for several weeks, up to 6 weeks, sometimes longer, and some of the distances covered are, you know, up to 800 kilometres or more, covering over 20 kilometres a day. It's quite an ordeal.
Harry wasn't on one of these marches. That came later. He was transported to the Neustellag in Fellingbostel, again via train. In his memoir, Harry writes that it was in the Stellag in Thorn that he had his jaw broken, he says, after being knocked around by a guard. He undergoes horrendous treatment at a German frontline hospital. His jaw is wired shut and a tooth extracted so he can suck food through a rubber hose. The day afterwards, he's transported from Stellag 357 in Thorn via a horse van assigned to sick prisoners to what becomes the final camp of his internment, Stellag 357 Erbke, near Fellingbostel in Germany, where he remains for 7 more months until early April 1945. He's finally liberated, he says, again in his memoir, on the road in late April or early May 45 by the British Army. And from what I can best work out, this was near the town of Wittenberg on the River Elbe, after what Harry says was many weeks of marching, covering some 200 miles or 340 kilometres.
After marching all day, we were put in any enclosed paddock, sometimes a barn. We were living off the land, bandicooting spuds, sugar beet and the like. We were often raided by our own aircraft, as we had a unit of German soldiers marching in front of us and a bicycle battalion of Romanian soldiers at our rear. It was supposed that we were being used as a shield, that our aircraft would recognise us and not raid. But they raided all right.
When the moment of freedom came, Harry was in a barn with other Allied prisoners. After an escape attempt, he was picked up by a couple of SS soldiers and rejoined a huge international column of prisoners, including RAF mates he'd met some 3 or so years earlier in Mossborg. The British tanks came rolling up the road, and just like that, the show, as Harry calls it, was over. Harry was infested with lice, exhausted, and was suffering from great hunger and also dysentery.
And he's looking anxiously for the arrival of those Red Cross parcels, and which will mean, believe me, a great deal more in the days to come. The food in the enemy countries is getting shorter and shorter, and he will want that food from the Red Cross, and those comforts in the Red Cross are very, very badly indeed.
Those Red Cross parcels, which were so important, they had been coming through the port of Marseille, and that had been liberated by the Allies, by the Americans, in October 1944. So those Red Cross parcels stopped coming through in the final months of the war, and they've been evacuated from their camps. So the structure, the system breaks down. Another situation is that the camps are taken over by the SS and Gestapo. They're taken off the hands of the German military. So the conditions and the treatment of the prisoners becomes a lot harsher in these final months of the war. That the war ended when it did probably prevented a huge humanitarian crisis for the prisoners. They weren't in good shape. Seeing some of the photos, and particularly the camp at Fellingbostel, where your grandfather was towards the end of the war, there's quite harrowing photos from there that if you're showing them to an audience, most audience members will ask, are they prisoners of the Japanese or from Thailand or somewhere like that?
Because they're so skinny.
That's right, yeah. And the Australian war correspondent, Chester Wilmot, was with the British forces when they liberated Fellingbostel, and he'd observed the battlefield heroics of the Australians at Tobruk, where he talked about them being such physically imposing figures. And 4 years later, when he sees these men again in captivity in Germany, he said that, "I saw them in hospital and they were drawn, haggard, starved beyond description. Their limbs were like matchsticks, bodies shrunken till their bones stood out like knuckles."
From a whisper to a bang. So here I am now, in the forest at Bad Fellingbostel, the place of Harry's last prison camp. On a self-guided tour, and with tips from helpful locals, soon I will find the ruins of one of the original barracks, now just a concrete foundation covered in decades of lichen and shrouded by tall trees. Through a wire fence, I will look at the delousing building, the only original structure from the prison compound that still stands in a grassy paddock. I'll visit the Russian monument and cemetery, where the information plates tell me that up to 30,000 Russian soldiers died in the camps from illness, exhaustion and malnutrition. And I'll stand in front of the Gate of Freedom Memorial, built in 2005, to commemorate the liberation of the Stalags in the region by British forces on April 16, 1945. Between two small red brick walls, iron prison gates painted white stand ajar. Commemorative plaques from various nations, including Australia, are on the red bricks. An old bicycle from the 40s has been installed on the lawn in front of it as another symbol of freedom. But it's the first building I see that has the most impact. The tall, multi-storey building next to a train line that now houses the Fallingbostel Military Museum. Harry writes about seeing buildings just like this one on arrival in the camp by train, used to house Red Cross parcels, POW clothing, hay, grain and stores. This could be the first building Harry saw after laying down on that platform, exhausted and broken.
I've just arrived at the military museum just outside of Bad Fallingbostel. As you can hear, it's incredibly windy. Hang on, I'll have to shelter. This was the last POW camp that my grandfather Harry was in, and right along the driveway alongside it are flags. So I can see two Australian flags here, Canadian flag, French, Italian, German, of course, and British flags. But it's a beautiful day. It's got Union written on the side of this building. There's also a train line right alongside it, so I imagine this would be where the troops would have been unloaded. And I have to say I'm very emotional about being here because I was reading the memoirs again on the way down here from Berlin, and this is the time when Harry turned up here with a broken jaw that had... And this was one of the most harrowing parts of his journey in Germany. He shaved the dead here and prepared them for burial. He was asked to by a doctor. He was a barber by trade. And the first episode of that for him with his broken jaw was very difficult. He hadn't been exposed to, you know, a corpse, an allied corpse like this before, I think, just lying in a hospital room. And he vomited into his jaw, into his mouth that was wired up. And he said eventually over time he hardened to the task of preparing these bodies for burial. So he would go out with other soldiers who were assigned the task of burying the dead. And they would go out on horses and carts and use the same coffin over and over. He said the Russian soldiers were the ones who had to do all the digging. They were treated extremely badly here. And they would bury the dead every day. He would also shave a lot of the POWs who were in the hospital. They had skin diseases, and he said they had to wear hoods because they looked so bad and their skin was in really bad shape, but their morale was always boosted after he shaved them. And it wasn't just shaving their facial hair, it was shaving the dead skin cells. And he was in the hospital while his jaw was healing. Imagine, and then one day in April, they were told they were moving on. I can't imagine what it would have been like for him here. You can hear the flags flapping. I'm under a German flag. It's just astonishing to think of who was here and how many different countries. I mean, we can't imagine what it would be like to go through this, to live here, not knowing the outcome when you'd get home, whether you'd even make it to the next day in one piece. I mean, it's a miracle he even came home after what happened to him.
The time is probably right for me to tell you that I'm not here alone. My husband is with me. His name is Oliver, and he's also German. I'm not sure what Harry would think of this, but my auntie Delma, Harry's daughter, who you met last episode, assures me that they'd get on like a house on fire. Harry wasn't anti-German. Like any soldier who'd survived a conflict such as World War II, he was anti-war. And the singular memory I have of him talking to me as a little girl about the war, other than telling me about how big the dung beetles were in the African desert, was that he was grateful to have been a prisoner of war in Germany and not in the Pacific. He said that the Germans treated you like, and I'm quoting here, a gentleman. Not always true, as his harrowing war memoir reveals, but it is also dotted with extraordinary kindnesses on both sides of enemy lines, such as the German guard who, Harry writes, took pity on him in his sorry state en route to the Stalag in Fallingbostel. He says that this German guard shouted Harry and his fellow prisoners in the horse van a jug of beer when they were stopped at a station. So Oliver's been right by my side on my POW pilgrimage here in Europe. And as a German born in 1963, he's done an enormous amount of reckoning and remembering already for the role that Germany played in the wars of last century.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we were very well informed in school about the atrocities of World War II and especially what the Germans did and the concentration camps and all the killings and... we were, all of us young people, like in our late teens, early 20s, we were also protesting against atomic bombs and Reagan, and we were political quite out there. And but we also realized that this was the doing of our forefathers. So, but we also understood the importance that there is no way to say as a German, we have nothing to do with this. So we were definitely very prepared to always honor and talk about the atrocities of World War II and Nazis and all of this and make sure that this will never happen again.
So what's it like for you, me dragging you around to all these old World War II sites when my grandfather was a POW?
Well, it's an interesting perspective which I didn't have before, because I guess I only saw it from the side of the Germans, that we were the bad Nazis and this was all horrible, and of course the atrocities against the Jews. So I was never really thinking about the prisoners of wars. I was thinking of some, in some context, of the German prisoners of wars, because I knew some history about that, and it took also them up to 10 years to come back. And so this was, especially in Moscow, quite personal experience to understand and learn more about what your grandfather and his peers have been through. And this was an angle of war and history I didn't know yet, and I think it's also very, very worthwhile keeping that memory alive and talking about that.
As Oliver just mentioned, we had already visited the site of Harry's first internment camp, Stalag 7A in Mossborg. Located 500 kilometres south of Fallingbostel, it's a small town of about 18,000 people, and it's deep in the heart of Germany's lush, hops-growing country in Bavaria. So let's rewind now and go back there and meet some more German citizens who are also dedicated to remembrance, to keeping history alive and tangible for people like me who turn up out of the blue wanting to see what's left of the prison camp and to know what their POW relatives went through.
Yeah, I know. It's difficult to explain.
We'll just keep documenting each other.
Please meet Christina Fosmeier and Gunther Streller, my local guides for the day in Mossborg. Born just after the war in 1947, Gunther is one of the hard-working members of the Stalag Mossborg Association, a small band of volunteers whose undertaking is to document and archive as much as they can about the POW camp, to build memorials to Stalag 7A and to all who passed through it, and most importantly, to foster intercultural and intergenerational communication.
Okay, so where are we now, Gunther?
Just a few words about
Let me just say something before. What you see is not always what you get.
Born in the same year as me, 1966, Christina is a passionate artist who's determined to recover POW stories and to give those who were invisible in the camp a voice. A journalist and a fierce ally of the association, she also works tirelessly to preserve the camp's history. especially its one original barrack that still stands. We meet in front of a cathedral in the town square. Reportedly, the relics of martyr St. Castellus are inside, a cause for pilgrimage over the centuries. Now, though, the town receives pilgrims of a very different persuasion, here for Stalag 7A, and each year some 50 or so descendants of POWs from around the world come here, and another 100 or so visitors to the City Museum, which houses hundreds of artworks and artefacts from the Stalag, plus a giant model of it made to scale. It may not sound like many visitors, but those who come here are hungry to see, hear and to know about the camp and its history.
We call it Heimat Museum. That means a museum of local history.
Wow. There's a lot of stuff in here. Wow.
Bernhard Kerscher is the museum curator. In German, he told Oliver that when he was a child, he used to play with the POWs at Stalag 7A, as his father was a camp cook.
So Bernhard is looking in the visitors' book, and there was an Australian here. May I get over there for a second? He was here 1 year ago. We came here from Australia to see where my father stayed as a prisoner of war in Stalag 7A. He was here between September 43 and May 4th of May 1945. It's been an honour to visit here and experience what my father and many others went through. Thank you for showing us this. Oh, thank you for saving this museum. And it's signed from a family. Wow.
That's the part of the museum that is dedicated to the Stalag 7A and the internment camp. I think the camp was 350,000 square metres big.
Wow.
So just imagine.
So, Bernard, the Stalag. Yeah.
This is noch Tisch vom Stalag.
That's an old table from the Stalag, yeah. So there's some beautiful paintings here from the POWs.
And this is auch vom Stalag.
Oh, wow. So this is an old chair.
This is noch vom Stalag.
Looking at this world of objects in front of me that so many hands have made and touched and used under such difficult circumstances, I wonder what the locals who've lived here for generations think about this place, this museum. I ask Gunther.
The older people don't want to remember and to talk about that history. They say that it's an old history, but don't care anymore. But the grandchildren have more interest because the generation has such a distance in time to that history that it is really has become history and was not no personal concern about that. That's why we try now to continue that work in fact to build a proper museum, but it will take some time because we have no room. This is the only room, two rooms above, but that's the only thing for Stalag.
So why are you involved in this?
Because it's part of the history and we need to know the roots of the town. This camp has been essential for the development of the town after the war. On the other hand, Moosburg has very old roots from the medieval times. So we have to see the whole history of a town to be conscious what happened and also what should not happen anymore. That's another point, to show destiny, yeah. To show the destiny of the prisoners, that all these people didn't want to have war. Yeah? They had to lose many years of their life in this camp, or in the camps, in the war, or even their life. And we have to be conscious what happened in the past.
Do you think we're in danger of forgetting? And what will happen if we do?
I think so, yes. Because people do not have any real imagination about what is war. They see it like something which is far away and where we are not concerned, but that can happen very quickly. In my generation, I was born after the war, we learned to build Europe. The politicians decided to avoid war in building this Europe. It was a project of peace, not only a economic thing or political thing, was a project of peace to avoid any further war between us. Because in the whole history of Europe, there's always war. Huh? So that's just in our generation, we are really happy that we lived without war.
And I think it's a danger that we forget that.
Oliver and I now travel in the car with Gunther and Christina for about a kilometre to the Neustadt, the new town, which has been built on the site of Stalag 7A, retaining its layout with houses on either side of the 700-metre-long main street that divides it. Each barrack housed up to 400 prisoners. Many of the buildings, residential and industrial alike, are remodelled barracks or new buildings that retain their design, some painted in pastel colours. Having looked at my grandfather's photos of Stalag 7A and the ones here on the public information plates in Mossburg, it is a surreal sight.
If you want, we can show you the last barrack of the which still exists. So here you see the rest of one of the barracks.
So it's surrounded by a temporary sort of cyclone fence and a lot of bushes have grown up alongside it. It's hard to see through it, but here we go. So this is an old building where the outside brickwork's fallen off. It's very overgrown and it's a very long building. And you've got stinging nettles that are growing up alongside it. And there's wooden doors here with the original iron handle.
It has, for a long time it has been verlassen.
It has been a desolate place for a long time.
And there have been young people who made parties inside and a lot of graffiti and because the town didn't want to keep it.
So and they just let it go.
But meanwhile, it's under protection.
This original barrack would really be the place for people coming over to Germany to have a look at the places where the fathers or grandfathers lived and they get emotional when there's something original. So this is the last original place where they could put their hands on.
And do you feel sad when you come to see this dilapidated building?
I could cry. Yeah? I really could cry because it's original. It's history.
Mm. It must be so complicated for you to be involved in some aspects in this.
I'm from a generation that always had to, as we say, put ash on our heads.
What does that mean?
We had to be ashamed of our history. War was constantly at the table. My father talked a lot about the war, but didn't say much. And so I could push that away. I had to push that away because I said, one day, I have the trauma, not you. But I see that times are changing and it's getting better now. It's getting easier to talk about it because I'm coping with it. I'm trying to get people interested in that part of history.
But you're also trying to keep that memory alive for good reason too, aren't you?
Yeah, just like Gunther said, it has to be kept alive to never to do that again. And Megan, may we ask you, what do you feel when you see that?
Well, I'm kind of grateful that I'm very distracted. It's very surreal for me because I'm kind of working. But there was a moment just before when I was looking through that window, I could see the kitchen, and I just wondered if my grandfather could have been in there. And I'm trying to hold back tears, really. So it's very emotional for me. I'm just kind of hiding behind my microphone so I don't break down myself. But I know if my father was here right now, and I'm kind of doing this on behalf of him, he would be probably a mess right now, yeah.
My dear Daddy, I received your welcome letters yesterday, and I was very pleased with them. Margaret, Mummy and I are all right, hoping you are the same. Mummy was going to buy me a bike for my birthday, but then the man said I could not have a bike unless I live a few miles away from my school. I'm in the fifth grade now. Auntie Zenny came up to take me down to her place for a week after Mummy being so sick. I must close now, Daddy, from your loving son, Bobby.
My dad was 9 when he wrote that letter to his father, Harry. It's February 1945 and Bobby hasn't seen his dad for 5 years. He, younger sister Margie and their mum Lil, Harry's wife, my grandmother, are boarding with a couple in Melbourne. Money's tight, so Lil's taken a job as a tram conductor. She's also been sick with rheumatic fever. Harry receives a letter when he's still in Stalag 357 near Fallingbostel. Although he doesn't know it yet, he's only a few months away from freedom. So is his younger brother, Nathaniel. After being recovered separately on the road in northern Germany by the Allies, then flown back to England, they chanced to meet each other in the street. Neither brother knew whether or not the other had survived the war until this moment.
Arriving in London, I went to Australia House, and who should be right at the entrance door? None other than my brother. We hadn't seen or heard of each other for months, as we were separated when I left camp number 357 in Germany at Fallingbostel. I went on the march before he did. He told me he had only marched for 2 days and was released, whereas I marched for weeks. He looked well and had been in England much longer than me, and would be on his way home before me too. He was meeting his mates and going on some outing for the day. I never saw him again until after I came home.
Fellow citizens, the war is over. The Japanese government has accepted the terms of surrender imposed by the Allied nations, and hostilities will now cease.
You might think that Harry would have been over the moon about surviving his ordeal and going home to be reunited with his family. Reading his memoir, it wasn't necessarily the case.
The journey was not very exciting, as I know my thoughts were all jumbled up as to what to expect, what to say, what type of questions to ask, whether I had changed, and many other thoughts were in my mind. To make matters worse, I was finding it impossible to sleep. And the confused state of mind, to say the least, was extremely upsetting.
Let us remember those whose lives were given, that we may enjoy this glorious moment, and may look forward to a peace which they have won for us.
It took a few days before the acceptance of the armistice sank in, as it was too good to be true that the World War of 1939 to 45 had actually ceased. There were celebrations everywhere, though I didn't partake as I was feeling ill, and my thoughts were of the future. My worry was as to how I would fit in with the civilian population, as really we had nothing in common, and it was going to be difficult for me to adjust. This I had to do, and very quickly. First, I had to see about getting work.
He happily discharges from the army pretty shortly after arriving home in Melbourne in August 1945. For the next few months, and across the years, Harry is in and out of hospital, and writes that he had a lot of trouble settling. For the previous 4 years, his world had been turned upside down, and if his memoir, which he wrote in several goes between 1980 and 1985, is anything to go by, what he'd been through was a surreal fever dream, just like it's been for me to read it.
My name's Christina Toomey. I'm a professor of history at Monash University. I've recently published a book called The Battle Within, POWs in Post-War Australia.
Christina's book is a deep dive into the lives of returned POWs after they made it back to Australia from both the Pacific and European theatres. And it explores the difficulties that ex-POWs, such as Harry or Nat, and their families faced after they got home from the war.
There's a few things we need to think about. The first thing is the attitude of the army and the repatriation authorities to them. So they received a very clear message pretty early on that they weren't to think of themselves as any different from any other returning service personnel. And the fact is that they had had a really different war. They'd been interned or imprisoned in camps and therefore had a series of issues and feelings about that experience that were uncommon to other service personnel. So there was no specific service available to help them transition, if you like, back into civilian life. So while they might have felt different and might have felt as if they had specific problems, the army and the doctors and people they were dealing with were not interested in exploring that with them.
And that was motivated by several factors, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. So the main factor really was that the army looked upon being a prisoner as a matter of dishonour. They felt that if they gave anything special to prisoners of war, future generations of service personnel may be discouraged from fighting on because they would know that there was some special prize at the end of it, which to our ears just sounds completely out of line, but was in keeping with the kind of attitude that the army had to them in the 40s.
Lachlan Grant told me that in Australia, over 1 million people served in the military during World War II, with thousands of others working in industries directly supporting the war effort. So after 6 years, generally speaking, and as you might expect, people were very ready to move on with their lives and perhaps not that interested in hearing more stories of hardship that were endured by returned POWs and veterans alike, which could make things difficult at home.
One of the most interesting things I found, I think, is the attitude of particularly women who were married to returned prisoners. I think they actually carried a lot of the burden as well. So one would never want to move away from the suffering of the individuals who'd been in prison. But the burden of that care also transfers onto wives who pick up a lot of that emotional labour that's required to look after a damaged man. Of course, there are female prisoners as well, but the vast majority of them are men. And different groups in the community also have a different response. So some people are very genuinely empathetic towards these returned prisoners, but others are really critical. And in the book, I look at some of the correspondence from people who say that some fellow service people criticised them for surrendering, that employers were not sufficiently sympathetic to the kind of issues that they had, and that they would prefer to work in jobs where they were their own boss, because many of them had trouble with authority and it just triggered them. So there's all sorts of flashpoints, if you like, where the particularity of their experience bumps up against things they have to do in terms of work, in terms of family. And there were particular areas where I saw that men had idealised and romanticised the idea of home. And when they came home to a wife and to a family, the fantasy of it had been so strong as a way of getting through captivity that when they had to live in the reality of a messy family life, that also then bumped up against some of their expectations. So there's all these points that are flashpoints for triggering memories of captivity or the psychological difficulties of dealing with some of its features.
Both Christina and Lachlan agree that we can never really know the suffering of those who live through an experience such as this. Christina says what we owe our POWs is our understanding and visible acknowledgement.
From all your research and having written this book and just sort of taking a step back and putting the whole picture together, in your estimation, what kind of a collective effect do you think it had on Australia as a society and on these men trying to put their lives back together?
I think it's probably important to separate the two things out, the individual from the national. And I think it's probably also important to recognise that there were people who came home and, with the support of people around them, resumed where they'd left off and had an okay life. But there's a core of people who are really profoundly damaged by that experience. And my sense is that that core of people are those who were off to a rocky start in the first place. So we have to think about their family of origin, their education levels, their capacity for work. All of those things could feed into a perfect storm of disadvantage. How have we as a nation come to terms with it, I think, is another question again. I think once people understood about the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, some of those earlier feelings of ambivalence that I was describing about prisoners of war potentially being failed soldiers or emasculated men or whatever spin you want to put on it, some of that ambivalence wears away once there's a growing public perception that traumatic events can happen to anyone. They don't have to be already frail or weak people. And I think that really changes the way the community responded to these people, because there's better understanding about the psychiatric difficulties that they might be experiencing. So it changes across time. And from the 1980s and 1990s, we get much more revisiting of that experience and attempting to understand it again in a different way.
Well, to say the least, it's been a lot to take in, this story of my grandfather and what prisoners of war like him went through. And the emotion I've felt on my travels has been very real and quite heavy, but I also feel very necessary to experience in order to get a better understanding of his suffering, to learn from it, and also the incredible resilience he showed, of which I am truly in awe. So while I'm digesting all this, I'm going to give the last word today to my wise Auntie Delma, as I did last episode, when she spoke about how hard it was for Harry to show love towards others after what he'd been through in the war. Someone who, with a very open heart and open ears, learned so much from Harry, her father, and the trials that he went through.
Do you miss your dad?
Yeah, very much. We were given good good values, base values, I think.
By your dad, that's his legacy to you?
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that he couldn't show his love gave me the ability to know that that's so important in life, because he missed it. And him and Mum couldn't work their problems out, but that was the war and whatever, whatever. And so I think that's a gift to me from him, is that I've been able to learn to love. But in valuing how hard it was for Dad, it's opened me up to being able to show it to my ones I care about. There's a lesson in everything, isn't there? There's the good and the bad. And if you only look for the bad, that's all you'll find.
You're amazing. Thank you.
Speaking today were Dr. Lachlan Grant, Oliver Budak, Gunther Streller, Christina Fossmeyer, Bernard Kauscher, Professor Christina Toomey and Delma Calcagno. You also heard the voices of Heath Big and Corwin Berry. Next episode, we'll travel to Ypres in Belgium to find the grave of Harry's older brother Richard, killed aged just 18 on the battlefield in World War I, and to experience an entire city as a war memorial. From a Whisper to a Bang is a podcast produced and presented by Megan Spencer for the Australian War Memorial. Music is by Cretan Australian world music duo Zaluris White, with additional sound by Jeremy Conlon and additional music by Jeremy Conlon and Michael Sheriffs. Mastering is by Chris Keogh. Grateful thanks to everyone involved in this episode. Also Gunther, Christina, Bernard and the Stalag Mossberg Association. To Kevin Greenhalgh from Fallingbostel Military Museum, Herr Brandes from the City Archive Office in Fallingbostel, to the team at the memorial, Nikki Kaznaxis, and to the Spencer family. You can find photos and more details about this episode on the From a Whisper to a Bang page at the Australian War Memorial website, awm.gov.au. And you can also subscribe to this podcast on your favourite podcast app. And thank you again for listening. Speak to you next time.